welcome back to History and Politics, the Körber Stiftung's podcast that deals with the question of how and why history shapes our present. My name is Gabriele Wojdelko, as you probably know, and it's my pleasure to welcome Katja Heuer and Oliver Moody, the hosts of our special podcast series on the New Germany. We have already reached episode number 5, and today it's all about the famous German Schuldenangst. Who better to discuss this with than Philippa Siegel-Glöckner, Managing Director of Dezernat Zukunft. And now, that's all from my side, and over to you, Katja and Oliver.
Ein jeder kehre vor seine Tür, und rein ist jedes Stadtquartier. Let each person sweep their own doorstep, and every part of the city will be clean. So wrote Germany's national poet Johann Wolfgang von Goethe in his Zarmaxenion, a collection of folk wisdom. And so said Angela Merkel on the global economy on the eve of the pandemic, the message being, if everyone looked after their state finances as responsibly as Germany does, the world would be a better and more prosperous place.
Germany's thing for economic discipline is almost proverbial. The black zero is standing for a balanced state budget, is a national symbol. Strict constraints on public borrowing are enshrined in the country's constitution, and they are overwhelmingly popular.
Across the road from my office in Berlin, the German Taxpayers Federation has rigged up a giant digital board showing how the national debt ticks upwards with every passing second. But where does this horror of indebtedness come from? Is it really a deep-rooted German tradition? Does it actually benefit the country? And most importantly, as Europe staggers from one crisis to the next, and the state finds itself pouring hundreds of billions into pandemic rescue funds, gas bills, and weaponry, how much longer can it go on?
You're listening to The New Germany, a series from the Körber Stiftung's History and Politics podcast about how the country is rising to the enormous challenges of the present, or belly flopping under the bar. My name is Katja Heuer, and I'm a German historian and writer based in Britain.
And I'm Oliver Moody, a British journalist in Berlin. Katja, have you ever fancied yourself as a Swabian housewife?
I can't say that I have. I don't really have the patience to eat Maultaschen dumplings, let alone to make them. How about you? Mercifully, I can't quite picture you in a pinafore chopping up unspeakable parts of a pig.
I don't know, but I certainly can't imagine Angela Merkel doing that. But the Schwäbische Hausfrau has been something like the mascot of fiscal prudence in Germany, ever since Merkel conjured her up to denounce the evils of public borrowing in 2008, during the early days of the Eurozone debt crisis. You could simply have asked the Swabian housewife, Merkel told the CDU party conference in Stuttgart, and she would have given us a pearl of worldly wisdom. You cannot live beyond your means for long. And as a British person, this really reminds me of Margaret Thatcher, the grocer's daughter from Grantham, likening the British state finances to her father's accounting ledger back in her childhood home. But by the way, do you know how Swabian matriarchs used to make sure their prospective daughters-in-law were good enough to marry their sons?
Let me guess, they tested them on the works of Friedrich Hayek?
Strangely, they did not. They would actually give the poor girl a piece of cheese and watch what she did with the rind. Because if she ate it, she was too vulgar. But if she cut it off, she was wasting too much cheese. So you wanted a bride who would just very carefully and precisely pare the rind away in this kind of Goldilocks fashion. As the old German saying has it, der größte Schatz für einen Mann ist eine Frau, die sparen kann. The greatest treasure for a man is a wife who can save money.
All right, Friedrich Schiller. That's quite enough moralising German folk rhymes for one day, I think.
For once, I agree with you. But the Swabian housewife seems to encapsulate this notion Germany has of itself as a nation of thrifty households under a thrifty government. And we'll explore a little later how well that image actually corresponds to reality. But at any rate, it appears to be part of the national mythology. For example, the Sparkassen, the regional savings banks, have a legal duty to promote saving in schools. And there's even a travelling exhibition called Schulden sind doof und machen krank. Debt is dumb and makes you ill. And as a non-German, I'm really interested to hear what you think the deep cultural background of this all is, because there's one theory that it's got something to do with Lutheran Protestantism. There's an economist at Trier University who published a paper that found that during the European debt crisis, the turmoil had a significantly bigger impact on the happiness of Protestants in Germany than on any other religious or non-religious group. In another paper, he suggested that MPs from the centre-right Christian parties were more likely to vote against the Greek bailouts if they had a larger percentage of Protestants in their constituency. It's sometimes suggested there might be a linguistic element as a second factor. Famously, the words for guilt and debt, Schuld and Schulden, are nearly the same. And in fact, when we were planning this podcast series with our friends at the Körber Stiftung, I absentmindedly got the two terms mixed up and they thought we were doing this episode on about German guilt. And then finally, you get all kinds of theories in the third category that it's something to do with historical trauma, such as the 30 Years' War or the hyperinflation crisis of the early Weimar Republic, or just the general roller coaster of ruination and uncertainty that has been the past four centuries of German history. So which of any of those things do you think it is?
Well, as an East German heathen, I can certainly not really comment on like Protestant angst. I mean, unless that's like something ingrained in the soil of where I grew up, just outside of Berlin. It isn't something that would have affected the community I lived in. But this kind of idea, I think, of like saving being sort of virtue, overspending, I think is an ingrained, possibly all German one. I mean, there's this idea that, you know, going back to the Swabian housewives, that certain regions in Germany are more obsessed with it than others, such as Swabians, for example. But I think in general is a very German thing. I remember when I was a teenager and I wanted to have a motorbike and did my driving license for one, and then basically wanted that as my sort of 18th birthday present, at least subsidized by my parents. And I remember even my friends who were really not you know, what you'd consider sort of prim and proper, certainly not all of them, like frowned upon the idea that I would squander away, you know, this kind of gift that I would be given for my 18th birthday on something as frivolous as a motorbike. They were all getting sort of saving packages and contracts for, you know, house building and sort of life insurances and things like that, where their parents would basically deposit money for them to use later in life. And I just thought that's the most boring thing ever. How can you be 18 and sit there and, you know, think about when you're going to buy your first house when you're about 35 or 40 or whatever?
Have you still got the motorbike?
I haven't, and I haven't got a house either, so I think they were right with their prudence.
Well, there you go.
So, yeah, there you go. I suppose there's something in that, but it is a very interesting thing that even with, you know, children or young people, it's already ingrained in you that saving is the way to go. So I would argue there is a cultural component to that, and whether that's reflected in the linguistics or in the history or in the various religious connotations, I don't know where that exactly comes from, but it's certainly there, I would say.
And I think that as we've seen with the Swabian housewife metaphor and also with Margaret Thatcher, there's a real tendency to conflate private debt with national debt, even though they're subject to very different economic rules in some ways. So please can you just walk us through a quick tour of where Germany's modern attitudes to public borrowing come from?
Oh, I mean, where do you start? Something that springs to mind, if we want to go all that far back, is that fight Ludwig von Zeckendorf, with the beautiful name that he had, wrote a sort of works in 1655 called Der Deutsche Fürstenstaat, which you could argue was the first German work of economics, in which he basically warned the princes that uncontrolled borrowing would be bad for you know, sort of state expenditure. And in that respect, you know, even before Germany actually existed as a nation state, you already have this idea that those in power mustn't overspend. And the same theme is carried through to such illustrious figures as Frederick the Great, who was also quite well known for his fiscal restraint and for making that a policy. He famously kind of lived by the motto, denn eine reiche Regierung kann und muss den Untertanen helfen, eine verschuldete aber kann niemandem beistehen. Which basically means that a rich government can help its people, whilst one that is in deep debt can't help anybody. And that's, I think, a sort of motto that carried on, you know, sort of through the centuries, if you will. You also had in the, going forward to the 19th century, you had sort of, you know, banks who began to link private spending and public spending together, making it sort of a virtue for individual people to save money as well as the state to do the same thing. And people were, in times of war and in times of peace, actually constantly encouraged to improve the fortunes of the state, you know, by sort of not squandering the money and ensuring that state finances would be in a healthy state. One thing that I found particularly interesting when I researched for my first book, Blood and Iron, was that even when Germany was founded in 1871 on the back of the Franco-Prussian War, the money that came out of that, so the reparations that France had to pay, came in actual gold coins. So basically, you had actual chests of gold, which that those reparations were kind of deposited in. And they were taken to Spandau and put in the Juliusturm and the Julius Tower. And it was said that even at the time, you know, this kind of feature quite large in the imagination of the people. You've got this sort of fort, you know, with chests of gold in it, which was kept there literally as a war chest. But of course, the idea that wouldn't be spent until you go to war was there, and it was used in the build-up to the First World War as well. And in terms of, you know, we've got the money, we can go to war. But of course, it wasn't anywhere near in the vicinity of what was actually needed to fund the First World War.
I mean, how did it work out for the German Empire? How many kind of shells did all those French gold coins buy in the end?
Well, I tried to sort of calculate that at the time because that intrigued me as well when I wrote the book. And I think I came up with a figure that had lasted just a mere few days, really, into the First World War, which, of course, lasted 4 years. So it really didn't do what it said on the chest.
I mean, that just sounds to me like completely the opposite. A parable that shows completely the opposite of what it's supposed to show, right? Which is that actually they'd have been vastly better off if they'd invested that money instead of just leaving it in a tower in a cistern on the outskirts of Berlin.
But yet that metaphor lasted. I mean, it's interesting that the term Juliusturm, you know, was used in West German politics in particular after the Second World War still as a metaphor for, you know, we're putting money away, we're saving it. And any time the state was that sort of expenditure left in the bank as opposed to creating debt, it called that a Juliusturm. You know, so this idea of having the war chest still in the tower was there and it lasted.
So since we've got on to the First World War and we've already alluded to the hyperinflation crisis of 1921 to 1923, tell us a bit about that. Was it really the kind of nation-defining trauma that it's sometimes made out to be? Or could one make a case that actually the real hammer to the German 20th century was the Wall Street crash, sort of 6 years or 7 years down the line?
I'm not entirely convinced that hyperinflation was the one moment that did it. I think the 1920s in general did, because people came out of the First World War and entered a phase where there was real poverty to the point of, you know, starvation, child mortality went up. It was basically a huge, immense drop in living standards from just 4 or 5 years before in 1914. And I think that collapsed into economic instability when, you know, 1914 suddenly seemed as a time of stability and kind of high living standards, even though that's not entirely true either, was what created this impression in people's minds, not hyperinflation specifically. And then, of course, it culminates in 1923 when money virtually becomes worthless. That always has a psychological effect when you've basically got money in your pockets and yet you can't afford to buy anything with it. Which I guess many people are beginning to sort of experience now again, what that actually feels like. You know, you feel sort of helpless. You go into a shop, you haven't got your own piece of land anymore to grow things on, and you can't buy, you know, basic things like groceries, flour, whatever, you know, you sort of need for your daily life. And the Wall Street crash, I think, sort of perpetuated this idea of you know, you being at the mercy of economic tides. But I think it also created the angst in the minds of politicians, because in many ways, hyperinflation seemed fixable because of the way that American loans came in after that to stabilize the economy. Whilst the Wall Street crash is seen as one of the key factors why the Nazis came into power, which then, of course, led to all of the huge catastrophes that emanated from that for Germany. So I think in many ways, what's stuck in people's minds is that entire time period as a time of economic calamity, and that the fallout from that was the biggest war that the world had ever seen, and the genocide, the Holocaust that came with it as well. And all of that, I think, is mixed into the same kind of psychological whole, not kind of those two events just on their own. So do you think that all of this post-war turned Germany into a nation of thrifty Swabian housewives as they were trying to avoid these calamities into the future?
I mean, yeah. Nein. Jein. I think you've got to go back to this distinction between private savings and public fiscal restraint being very different beasts in reality. So in terms of household savings, if you go back to 2019, which is the last year before the pandemic and all the associated fiscal stimulus does very strange things to private finances, German households saved 18.3% of their income, which is a lot. It's the highest level in the EU, although the Dutch and the Swedes are not a long way behind. But then if you look at the record of post-war Germany on public borrowing, it's unremarkable. To put it mildly. So the founder of the post-war social market economy, Ludwig Erhard, had a kind of Reaganite, borderline Liz Truss horror of the large state. He described the sort of senseless and soulless termite state with its depersonalization of humanity, that social democracy, in case it's unclear. He called state spending a parasite on the body national. And you had a period in the mid-1950s when Fritz Schäfer, Konrad Adenauer's finance minister, did actually put the government budget in surplus for 5 years in a row. And those were the Julius-Turm budgets you were talking about earlier. That metaphor really did carry through. But there weren't very many more of those. In fact, the last West German finance minister who balanced the books until very recently was Franz Josef Strauß in 1969. And then if you go forward to German reunification, there's absolutely massive public debts incurred. And then they're trying to curve the deficit at the end of the 1990s. And then you get this great story about the rock star finance minister. Would you like to hear it?
Go on, of course I do.
So this is Hans Eichel, who had earned himself the nickname Sparkommissar, the Commissar of Saving, in his native state of Hesse. He's also nicknamed the paperclip with glasses. And he was so good at saving public money that he was brought in by the Chancellor Gerhard Schröder for this austerity drive in 1999. And for a couple of years, he really wrestles down the budget with all of these initiatives. And to trumpet this, Eichel's finance ministry hires a rock band called Decibel from Berlin to write a song about him with the title Er, wer sonst, He Who Else. And I've tried to translate some of the lyrics here into rhyming English. His pockets, they aren't full of dough. He doesn't spend like a hero. He'll meet you over a pint of beer or chips from the fast food joint here. He is thrifty, diligent, and sometimes accommodating. He, who else? And sadly, I couldn't dig up a recording of this song. But I did find a satirical tune by the German satirist Reinhard Graeber about how Hans Eichel named all of his daughters Hans in order to save on business cards.
Töchter heißen alle Hans. Das spart Visitenkarten, sparen geht uns alle an. In unserem Portemonnaie ist ein Loch.
But anyway, the punchline of this, which definitely proves the point about German post-war fiscal policy not always living up to its image, is that immediately after this song was released, Germany actually had such a large budget deficit that it broke the EU's fiscal rules that Germany had designed according to its own purposes for 3 years running. So it's not always what it pretends to be.
Yeah, it's a shame we couldn't have, you know, recorded the song again here. You could have sung that song. It would have been beautiful. Well, I'm afraid it's not, you know, all rock star kind of glamour going forwards from there on. You do get a brief period where Pierre Steinbrück, the finance minister at the time, developed the first balanced budget again for almost half a century in 2007, and everybody got very excited about it. But the debt to GDP ratio reached an all-time high of 81% again just 3 years later in 2010. So as you say, it isn't all that it is kind of made out to be. In order to try and deal with this in some capacity, and also because of this kind of, you know, obsession that we just talked about with saving throughout the centuries that hasn't really gone away, you end up with a debt brake being written into the constitution in 2009. And it's interesting that this was done by a huge majority in the Bundestag, so signed off by various political parties, which you do not often see, I would argue, in other countries where basically from the left to the right, you have people agreeing that kind of fiscal prudence should be part of the constitution, which is kind of quite an extreme idea. Although we should say that this isn't an entirely German idea as such. It's loosely inspired on something that Switzerland had done before. Again, maybe that's not overly surprising, given that the Swiss have also got a reputation for financial prudence. And it's not quite as stringent as the Swiss version either, which obliges actually the government to pay back any borrowing, whilst the German federal government is only prohibited from running a deficit of more than 0.35% of GDP. You then end up with a run of surpluses again from 2012 to 2019. But as we were just saying, the pandemic ended up doing very strange and quite calamitous things to the economy and to public spending in particular.
Yeah. And the debt brake is not as rigid as it might sound. There's a mechanism built into it that allows it to be suspended during economic emergencies, which as you just kind of hinted at, Merkel and Olaf Scholz, her finance minister at the time, used during the pandemic. And it's now been brought back into action. But since the Russian invasion of Ukraine last February, the government has used another ingenious trick to borrow a sum of money that's actually equivalent to the entire annual economic output of Romania or the Czech Republic. 100 billion for modernizing the armed forces and up to 200 billion for cushioning the blow from last year's rise in energy bills.
Yeah, and it does this through a tool known as the Sondervermögen or special fund, a sort of war chest. And here we have it again, raised from the markets for a limited time and a specific purpose. The idea is basically that it's a separate thing from normal government spending. And so it doesn't really officially count when you're balancing the books.
But, and this is a kind of interesting, but it's not clear whether this will be enough to deal with the consequences of the Titan vendor or turning point that Scholz declared last February. The German defense minister has just been openly lobbying his boss to increase the regular military budget, and the Germany's industry is clamoring for green technology subsidies to match those on offer from the Biden administration in the US. And so I think the really central question is, could the Titan vendor also disrupt Germany's economic policies, just as it has already upset Berlin's foreign and security policies? And I think we should ask an expert.
Our guest today is Philippa Siegel-Glöckner, director of Dezernat Zukunft, or the Department of the Future, an economics think tank in Berlin. Philippa's previous jobs include spells at the World Bank and the German Federal Finance Ministry under Olaf Scholz, where she worked closely with Wolfgang Schmidt, who is now head of Scholz's chancellery. As a well-connected member of the Social Democratic Party and a prominent critic of the debt brake, she has both an insider's and an outsider's perspective on Germany's approach on balancing the books. Philippa, welcome to the New Germany.
Thank you for having me.
Philippa, let's start with a very broad question indeed. Where do you see the historical roots of this very broad skepticism of public borrowing in Germany? When did it start to become a thing, in your view?
I think it's been a thing for a while. If you trace back the history of the debt brake, it didn't come out of nowhere. But I do have some doubts when people say, you know, this is all rooted in the hyperinflation that we experienced in the early 1920s. I think that ascribes a lot of collective memory to the public and to how they form their political opinions. I think it's more something that's been driven for good political reasons by certain political players that have kind of reinforced that theme in different ways.
And I wonder if there is a psychological component to it, though, for lack of a better word. So is it possible to compare that to thinking about private debt? Is it possible to talk about a sort of general aversion to debt? And if so, where does that come from?
Yeah, I find that a very, very difficult one. First of all, because being averse to government debt is actually not that unique to Germany. I mean, if you look at the US, for instance, in the Clinton years, I mean, he had a big political play on reducing the deficit. Now, Biden, with the Inflation Reduction Act, spending a lot of money, is making a claim that this is reducing the deficit. So I'm not that sure it's so unique. And then also to assume or pin down these very, very complex things like, you know, the public deficit on inherent cultural differences, I find difficult. That said, maybe where there is one difference, and I think it's quite notable in comparison to the US, for instance, we in Germany, I think, do feel a lot less comfortable with this, you know, let's just run the economy hard, let's just do whatever we can and be entrepreneurial. If that requires taking on a loan, you know, who really cares? If my income is going well, I'll buy a car on a loan, I'll take on student debt. That's not a thing in Germany. Both taking on loans for cars, and we like cars, and taking on loans to finance universities is very, very unpopular in Germany. So there's probably something to it, but I would be very careful to extrapolate from that to general preferences about fiscal policy.
You spoke a moment ago about how political actors can have a pretty significant effect on shaping discourse about debt in Germany. There have been times in fairly recent history when Germany has had quite large budget deficits, most famously around the early 2000s when it broke the EU's fiscal rules. Please could you tell us a bit about the politics of that and how the press and public opinion responded to that at the time?
Yeah, so that was in the Schröder years when he was also doing his big reforms and actually, yeah, had quite a staunch opinion on not at the same time having sharp fiscal consolidation, because he said, I can't do these structural reforms and at the same time depress the economy. That definitely made him vulnerable to attack, and the conservatives very much picked up on that and brought up this theme that's been, I think, going on for a while, but wasn't so active in the political discourse, about stability culture. And it was particularly pushed by the Bavarian CSU that really tried to get into a political fight with Schröder and trying to insinuate that he was spoiling the Deutschmark's heritage because he wasn't respecting the stability culture but taking on too much debt, which, I mean, is an interesting, quite big story suddenly about putting all of Germany's heritage on the line and attaching it to the currency.
Well, and you touched upon the idea that there is kind of like a story or an accepted narrative or kind of like an idea as to what German fiscal spending and policy should be like. Do you feel that the Eurozone financial crisis had any impact on this type of political discourse in Germany? And if so, how?
Yeah, that definitely had massive impact. I mean, this is also where I now switch from, you know, reading the history books and the press reports to having my own active memories. And that made a big difference because it's always very different when it's about other countries, right? And in the southern countries in Europe, we were always a bit worried about them not being serious enough about stability of the currency, being prudent enough in their fiscal policy. So I think when the debt crisis came around, that proved everything, that the skeptics were were warning about. And it's much easier when you don't see also the effect certain policies have to, you know, to be a lot stricter about it. I don't think if we had that austerity that we imposed on other countries, in Germany, we would have been that vicious. And it got quite a religious touch in a way. They have to pay for their sins. And even today, I think, when you talk to people about Italy and even people who would, you know, describe themselves as pro-European and progressive, there's still a lot of this notion of they have to pay for their sins, which is particularly ironic given that Italy's been running a primary surplus for longer than Germany. So you really, really see how it's become a debate that's been a bit removed from reality and has become very, very political, very emotional.
I think most listeners, including those in the UK and the US, would intuitively understand that the kind of basic economic case for balancing the budget. I don't think we need to rehearse the arguments there. But what is very interesting in Germany's case is that this obligation to balance the budget, or very nearly to do so, has been written into the constitution. Why was that in political terms? But also, what are the kind of fiscal or economic arguments for a government tying the hands of the state in this manner?
Yeah, there's a lot in this question. So maybe briefly on the economics, and I mean, I think this is really about political economy rather than economics. And then I'm going to try and disentangle why I think the debt brake ended up in the constitution. So the political economy argument was that, you know, politicians want to spend money so that they can give all the nice gifts to the electorate they need to get into office and stay in office. And that was very much the argument that was pushed. On the economic front, it's actually a lot trickier, I think, to make a stringent case of why you need a one-sided rule. So a rule that tells you you shouldn't be spending too much, because you can also underspend, you can underinvest, and you can depress your own economy. So I think that's a lot harder. What they said in when they justified the debt brake and its introduction was, well, Germany is aging, so we want to save money to make sure that the budget kind of stays all right for a shrinking, you know, population, shrinking tax base, and when we're paying more pensions. But that argument, again, I think is quite shaky, because what do you need to do to look after an economy which has an aging population? You need to make sure that everybody who can work works and earns a salary that's high enough to pay for their pension. So I think really the most stringent argument is the political economy one, and then you just have to look empirically whether that's wrong, and politicians have a tendency to always overspend. There has actually been quite a bit of academic work on this, and it doesn't hold up. So it can go either way. On the arguments introduced at the time, what's really interesting is that it's a huge mix of things, and disentangling them in the bill that introduces the changes to put the debt brake in its current form in the constitution. It really takes quite a while to dissect what's in there. So it's a bit about incentives. It's a bit about the aging population, intergenerational justice, without, interestingly enough, justifying it, which I think it needs, because, you know, if you underinvest in your education system and your transport system, all the effects we see today, that has little to do with intergenerational justice. And then another justification is the European fiscal rules that are claimed to have forced us to introduce the debt brake in that form. Actually, when you look a bit more closely, that doesn't quite hold up. We interpreted the European fiscal rules in the strictest possible way and then put that in the constitution. So I think that's a very particular German interpretation. And then the last one, and that's sometimes forgotten, is that we had a long-standing issue with our existing fiscal rules. So we actually had a fiscal rule in the constitution which allowed for investments, but was misdesigned in a certain way. And the constitutional courts had complained about this twice already. So it's not like it came completely out of nowhere, but still that it happened in 2009, I think, was due to quite special factors in the end.
If I can ask a quick follow-up question, is there also a case that it sends out some kind of signal to the bond markets that the Lannisters always pay their debts, and thereby perhaps the idea might be that it gives Germany a certain kind of premium on the cost of its public borrowing?
That is an argument that I've heard in recent times. It's not an argument that seems to have been particularly prominent at the time. I also wonder to what extent it was a worry, because actually when you're in crisis times, countries like Germany tend to benefit and pay lower interest rates because investors are looking for a safe haven for their money. So I'm not sure how much of a worry that was and whether one felt one really, really needed that. Maybe it was an additional justification. But I've heard this more in recent times as one of the reasons of why we shouldn't reform the debt brake.
And speaking of reforming the debt brake, and maybe to move a little bit from the sort of theoretical arguments about it into its practical implications, what have been the downsides, would you say, of the debt brake?
We do see these downsides pretty openly right now. I mean, they were already pretty, I think, obvious before COVID, but COVID with underinvestment in the public health system made it even clearer, and now underinvestment in the military is another case. So yes, huge underinvestment in pretty much all public services. That's the big point of discussion. I think also has kind of made the headlines a lot now and has maybe shifted the public debate a bit. Another factor or another impact that's sometimes forgotten, I think, or overlooked, is that we had a massive reduction in staff in the public administration. You know, maybe in some aspects justified. I don't want to say that's generally impossible, but we do see it at the local level, you know, in planning administration, in public services. We basically just don't have the people to make all the decisions we need to make. And it takes for, you know, 2 years to get, I don't know, a renovation in a building approved. When we just built LNG terminals in record time, people did calculations of how many staff we would need in the public administration to do everything at that speed. And the numbers they came up with, were pretty scary. So I think generally big underinvestment and a huge lack of capacity now in the public sector.
To bring the kind of Zeitenwende and the fiscal policy discussion together, it's been an interesting few years with the debt brake, because it was suspended to allow the state to deal with the economic shock from the pandemic. But now, since the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the government has chosen to step back down on the debt brake. And yet at the same time, it's also given itself room to borrow up to 300 billion in these so-called special funds for things like subsidizing energy bills and investing in defense. And yet, at the same time, there's clearly a lot more pressure on the government to increase the structural spending, the kind of basic annual budget, not least on defence. So I'm curious to know whether you think that this way of dealing with borrowing is really sustainable, and whether the Zeitenwende is ultimately going to make itself felt in economic policy as well.
I think it's definitely not sustainable in that sense that we have run into a problem with the fiscal rule. We didn't only start these big deficits with special vehicles funding the military, but actually already in COVID. And the way that the current government managed to find all the money they needed for all their various coalition projects was by changing the accounting rules under the debt brake, which allowed them to basically take on lots of debt in the COVID years where the fiscal rule was suspended, and then stash it away in a back pocket and use it for further years. And the Conservatives have gone to court over this, Constitutional Court, and we haven't gotten the final ruling yet, but in like a preliminary decision, the Constitutional Court already indicated they have a problem with changing the accounting rule that in a way that you can just stash away funds for later years. And I'm not a lawyer, but I can't see the economic rationale for explaining this change in the accounting rules. So I think we will get a problem with this. And then if you can't do that, one of the main mechanisms they've been able to use to get around the rules will be gone. So that will be a big problem. Military spending is a bit of a special case because there was really a very, very broad consensus. So they also got the conservatives on board for this to increase military spending, and hence they could actually do it outside the debt brake because they got a large majority and they could do a special purpose vehicle for this outside, which is properly outside the debt brake. In economic terms, I do think we're also running into a challenging time. Even if one is not scared of spending a lot of money, and I'm not that scared of expansionary fiscal policy, I think underinvesting is far more dangerous. The demands on the budget we have over the coming years are pretty big. For military, for decarbonization, for our education system, for infrastructure. So I do think we will have to think carefully about how to manage all of this. I'm not sure that the current fiscal framework we have helps a lot, because what it actually promotes is that you're overly tight on your core expenditures, so all the things that, you know, as a government you should regularly do, and then it gives you a lot of leeway on all these off-budget funds, which you can see in these very, very big sums that are taken on for crisis spending. And maybe just a final thought to give you a sense of dimension. For the energy crisis to cap gas and electricity prices, the government agreed to put away 200 billion in an off-budget vehicle. On the other hand, we're not willing to spend 10, 15 billion on the education system, which it really, really badly needs. We don't have enough teachers in schools at the moment. So it really shows you how it's getting pretty schizophrenic between big crisis spending and then quite small spending on important structural issues.
So if the current fiscal framework isn't really working, and there seem to be a lot of ways around the debt brake in any event, and also it doesn't look as if the sort of, you know, crises that we're seeing at the moment, particularly the economic fallouts, are going to go away anytime soon, does it really make sense to cling on to the debt brake?
May surprise you, I think yes. for a couple of reasons. I think it should be reformed, but actually I think removing the debt brake from the constitution right now would erode public trust. Fiscal policy is a lot about trust. Do people think the government's doing the right thing? Do they think their currency is valuable? All of that. In Germany, the political discourse has been such that everybody's equated responsible fiscal policy with sticking to the debt brake. So I think removing it today or tomorrow would be a problem. I also actually don't think that the debt brake stands in the way of more reasonable fiscal policy. Because as you said at the beginning, it's not a fixed deficit ceiling. It actually allows you to spend more if the economy is running under capacity. It then tells you to save money when the economy is running over capacity, when you have inflation, because there's so much demand, you have no unemployed people in the labor market. So, you know, you can't fire up the economy even more. And that principle is actually kind of sensible. It is the natural speed limit of an economy. So in my view, it would be a lot more sensible to reform how we calculate whether the economy is over or under potential, because the way they do that today is problematic, than to kick the debt brake out of the constitution straight away. Maybe in a couple of years, if also, you know, notion has changed in people's heads and they don't tie fiscal responsibility so much to it anymore, it's a different discussion. But I think where we are today, reforming the key problem inside the debt brake rather than taking it out of the constitution would make a lot more sense.
And if our listeners would like to follow the arguments that you've been making about Germany's fiscal policy in greater detail, is there anywhere that they can read your work in English?
Yes, they actually can. On our website, which you may have to put somewhere in writing because it's kind of hard to spell for an English person, detsanatzukunft.org. But we have actually translated all of our major papers on fiscal policy. So there's one on a new fiscal policy for Germany and one on the cyclical component of the debt brake, if you really, really like to get into the nitty-gritty of what's going on here. But it also does have a bit of the quite interesting history, actually, of the debt brake and, yeah, what I think we included what happened in 2009 and how this thing ended up in the constitution as a, which was a bit of a surprise to a lot of people.
We'll put a link to the website in our show notes. Philippa, thank you very much indeed for coming on The New Germany and giving us such lucid and thoughtful answers.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you, as always, to our listeners. We would very much like to hear your comments, whether positive or negative, although preferably no bags of dog dirt, please. We're not ballet critics.
You can find us on Twitter, if Elon Musk hasn't set fire to the whole thing by the time the episode comes out, at @Hoya_cat and @OliverNMoody. And thank you also to our endlessly patient hosts at the Körber Stiftung and its history and politics section.
Indeed. So long from Sussex.
And beehren Sie uns bald wieder. Goodbye from Berlin.